I'm Redbeard, and today we go in the studio for the story of Third Stage, Boston's 1986 multi-million seller, and the musician who brought free agency to the music business. I'm gonna say it like a man and make you understand, Amanda. I
love you. Somehow, I think somehow the Big Cheese didn't know that I recorded in my basement on my own stuff, and I didn't use anybody else, and I could sustain for quite a while without very much money a pretty strong recording effort. So I actually managed to finish that record, which was Third Stage, while CBS was suing me, and this went on for like 6 years. Hi, this is Tom Scholz in the studio for Boston's Third Stage album.
In late summer 1976, a totally unheralded album was released under the band name Boston, which was the result of 7 years of home studio recording by a musician and MIT engineering graduate named Tom Scholz and his friends. The first Boston album became the biggest selling debut in history. It's now sold some 17 million copies so far. But by the time the follow-up, 1978's Don't Look Back, was released, Boston's music was relentlessly cited by some as corporate rock, meaning glossy, soulless music made by formula for mass consumption and profit. The irony is that accusation could not be further from the truth. You see, by writing, arranging, playing, and recording everything in his own basement studio, Tom Scholz's Boston albums from the very first have been the epitome of independent creations. And much to the chagrin of at least one former head of a corporate rock company, Tom Scholz was seen as too independent, even obstinate. The first indication of friction between Scholz and his record company came when Tom failed to deliver the second Boston album in time to prop up CBS Records' fourth quarter sales in 1978. Over Scholz's vehement objections that he was not finished, and it's indicated by only 33 minutes of music, CBS Records physically removed the tapes and released them anyway as Don't Look Back in August 1978. In hindsight, Tom Scholz has a hunch on why he was rushed.
You know, the funny thing is I got the feeling afterwards that CBS had no confidence in a second Boston album, that they were just looking at it as cashing in the rest of the way on a band that had a good first album. And I have kind of always thought that they never expected it to sell 6 million copies. That was when I realized that how naive I was about the business. You know, I realized the record company did not care about the quality or anything like that, or getting the most out of what I could do. At that point, I felt that nobody did, not the manager, not the record company, and it was basically just me sort of against the world as far as trying to maintain my values in in pursuing music. I mean, there's a lot of people out there that don't have any values pursuing music, that just really want to be successful. And I don't have anything against them, but that's not me. I never really cared that much if I was a mega success or not, or a millionaire. I didn't get into it for that reason. I did want to make enough money to be able to pursue it as a lifetime career. But I just didn't care about the rest of that. And I realized that I was alone. I think that was the worst part of it.
Number one song, Amanda, comes from the 1986 album Third Stage by Boston. Tom Scholz contends that Amanda was not even intended to go on Third Stage.
Now, Amanda didn't end up getting done until, I believe it was 1981 that it got recorded, but we stopped everything after Don't Look Back was finished and went out on tour. And then I subsequently did a little redesign work on the studio. But when I went back to work in the studio, I believe it was in early 1981, I completed Amanda first. And, you know, it took a few weeks to do that song. It was very fast for me. I pretty much write everything close to home. I only write when I have an instrument in my hands. That was done either very late in 1980, after we were done with a huge, huge tour from Don't Look Back, or early in 81. It was around Christmas time. It was really the first serious thing that I sat down and tried to record a master of. It just went like magic. Everything worked. Every part I played, just nothing was a problem with that song. It was one of the few really really enjoyable moments in the studio. You know, most of the time in the studio is not a lot of fun, but that one was, because it went so smooth. And I don't know, it was sort of like I think that was sort of a gift to get started on Third Stage.
By this time, Boston had sold nearly 15 million albums in only 4 years. Yet, Tom Scholz remained relatively anonymous. With few exceptions, music writers don't like anonymity in their subjects, preferring to punctuate their prose with colorful characters. Tom Scholz of Boston wasn't even interested.
It's always some picture of some person trying to portray some kind of attitude. And I just didn't care about that. I really liked the music was what I was excited about. I wasn't trying to get anybody interested in, you know, somebody who was nastier, meaner, tougher, or had more tattoos than the last rock and roll band. So that was kind of behind the whole thing of just leaving the pictures off. I just didn't think it had much to do with the music. I don't know. We've always done those rare, those bizarre, unusual things. I mean, for instance, when Third Stage came out, Amanda was number one hit for, I don't know what, 4 or 6 weeks. It was the, in fact, it was, I think it was the longest running hit single of the year and the only number one single from a band that didn't have a video. So I am a born rebel and I can't help it. So as soon as somebody tells me I have to do something this way, I automatically, even if it's a good idea, I automatically start thinking about how else I can get it done. You know, and it's one of the reasons that I have stayed so completely away from videos, because I don't want to tell people with some visual or even lyrical image what they're supposed to be thinking about when they listen to the music. I really think people have better imaginations, and you can't. People are so different that you have to let them think. You have to give their mind the freedom to think. It's kind of like the difference between, I don't know, maybe it's the difference between like reading a novel and watching TV. You know, watching TV is a purely just mind-numbing sort of do-it-to-me, I'm not thinking experience. And reading a novel, you have to use your imagination to picture things. And so I try to make it like that.
Thank you.
A number 9 hit from Boston's 1986 comeback album, Third Stage, was entitled We're Ready. Up next, Tom Scholz details how his relationship with Boston's record company deteriorated while he slowly crafted a third Boston album. Be sure to follow In the Studio on Facebook and hear more Rockstar interviews at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, In the Studio with Tom Scholz, Boston's Third Stage.
Welcome back. In the Studio, I'm Tom Scholz with Redbeard.
Thanks, Tom. When Tom Scholz failed to deliver a third Boston album by the early 80s, his record company refused to pay him his earnings, known as royalties, and they refused for some 15 million Boston albums that had been sold by then. I asked Tom Scholz what effect this had on him.
Oh, geez, Redbeard. You know, I, the bottom line was that they were trying to enforce a contract that they hadn't lived by, and that they knew was totally unrealistic, and had benefited because of the fact that it had been ignored since day one. But this goes back 20 years. Record company would hand some band or some artist or some singer a contract that required him to do impossible things. And the guy had two choices. He could not sign it and, keep his day job and work for, $50 a night on Friday and Saturday night. Or he could sign this thing and hope that maybe it would somehow work out. But basically, they would get people to sign these deals that were just absolutely unworkable, knowing that they would always have a way to come back and withhold the earnings of the artist. I mean, I'm talking about people that would go in, make a successful record, go on tour to support it. It's not an easy business, and not an easy job to do that, and then hold on to all the royalties. And it has happened, or certainly most of them, once they get off the ground. And I was one of those cases. I hadn't been paid. I think my earnings went back something like 7 years of not being paid. In other words, they were still selling the records like crazy, and just didn't bother to pay me. And I had produced, played almost all the instruments on the album, arranged it, recorded it in my studio, and I wasn't getting a dime for it.
Yes.
Cool the Engines was another hit from Boston's Third Stage album. When CBS Records' failure to pay Tom Scholz for the first two Boston albums still did not result in Scholz delivering a third album, the record company decided to play hardball.
CBS sued me. And, you know, I'm not even sure to this day exactly what the heck their complaint was. I know why they sued. They sued because somebody there got ticked off at me, you know, doing what I do in the studio and on my own schedule. They had hoped for a record a lot sooner than I had gotten one done, and I was still quite a ways away. And I think they just got a little impatient. I think they got real impatient. As I understand it, there had been a long list of people that had run into trouble with that company. This is back in the days when it was run by Walter Yetnikoff. So I didn't really consider myself singled out. I think I was just next in line in a long list of artists that had been pounded on by a huge... And people have to understand, that company, and at that time, it was CBS Records, CBS, Network. It was huge. That company has resources that just boggled the mind. I mean, you're talking, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in revenues a year. And if they decide that they want to cause somebody some trouble with their legal staff, if they have any grounds at all, they can make it cost so much money that most people, including most recording artists, really can't afford to fight that lawsuit. And if you do and you win, you're still going to come out losing money. So, you know, because of the legal system in this country, it's just so slow and so just drawn out and just bizarre that it is possible for somebody to just spend you out of court. And I'm sure it happens a lot. And I think that they believed that I would be unable to record and unable to sustain during that lawsuit. But what they didn't pay attention to, I think, was somehow, somehow the big cheese didn't know that I recorded in my basement on my own stuff, and I didn't use anybody else, and I could sustain for quite a while without very much money a pretty strong recording effort. So I actually managed to finish that record, which was Third Stage, while CBS was suing me, and this went on for like 6 years.
So instead of being able to focus on making new music, Tom Scholz had to defend his right to make music in the manner and time which he saw fit against a virtual music empire. And Scholz was about to tell the emperor, "You have no clothes."
People don't realize how badly these recording artists really get victimized by these record companies. The record companies are huge conglomerates. I mean, they're just gigantic. They have the amount of resources in terms of financial resources. There's no comparison. People think that a successful artist is just swimming in money. And one that sells a lot of records is doing fine, or should be, and has everything they need. But compared to these Goliath record companies, you're nothing. I mean, you have very little to work with. And if they decide to get nasty and they have any kind of grounds that will hold up to get a case started in court, they can cost you everything you've got. And usually, from what I have seen in my case and with other people, it's usually not that there is a real serious intrinsic problem. It's usually personalities. The people that run to get into the position of controlling these major labels, these are not like your everyday nice people that are walking down the street. These are people that are smart and ruthless and, you know, have clawed their way and destroyed the competition until they got to the top. And you're not talking about a real sweet bunch of guys up there. So it's a tough, tough world. And, you know, they will be, they have, the ability to be, you turn on the charm, and then if there's something they don't like, bang, they just, you know, they throw a lightning bolt. So a lot of people thought I was really stupid for not just kissing butt and going along with it. And but I, unfortunately, I can't help it. I'm really rebellious by nature. And as soon as somebody does something to me that I think is wrong, I will not let go. I just keep going with it until it, you know, until I am satisfied with the result, or I have nothing left to fight with.
So for 6 long years, Tom Scholz of Boston was drawn into a legal David versus Goliath battle, fighting for his artistic and financial life against a formidable and previously undefeated giant. Like most musicians, Tom Scholz was ill-equipped for such a fight.
You know, you just don't know. As an artist, you're not an accountant, you're not a lawyer, you're not a businessman. You didn't go to Harvard Business School and learn how to be learn how to get anything you wanted from somebody that's unsuspecting. I knew how to, you know, I was an engineer, I was a musician, a songwriter. And unfortunately, people that fall in those categories, they have no clue. You can't understand a complicated contract. You have no idea what the legal ramifications are of the actions that the people around you are taking, or you know, even of the things that you sign. And it's crazy. So I had received in light of the what the eventual value was of that album, I mean, I had gotten peanuts, and I was satisfied. I really didn't. I had never gotten into it for the money anyways. I had a house. I had a studio in the basement. You know, I was very happy. But I had also was also existing on a tiny, teeny little fraction of the money that would normally be paid for such a huge, successful album. Well, eventually, they decided to just cut it off altogether. And I even put up with that, if you can believe that. And then they sued, and I was told later that it was, this guy Yetnikoff just got, it was a personal vendetta because I guess he had been insulted that over something that I had done or not done. And years later, they start the lawsuit, and the funny thing is, of course, they lost, and then they had to dig in and pay up the money, and it was astronomical. It was astronomical. I don't know if it was 10 times, 20 times what I had actually received. I mean, it was huge. It was most of the money. They still had it.
What does it take to be a man? What does it take to see it's a heart and soul, a gentle hand? So easy to want and so hard to give. How can you be a man till you see beyond the life you live? Oh, what does it take to be a man?
Thank you.
To Be a Man, featuring the tender vocal from Brad Delp, is from the Third Stage album by Boston. I'm Redbeard. Coming up next, you'll find out from Tom Scholz how Boston not only survived the protracted and costly legal battle, but actually managed to create one of the biggest comeback albums of the 80s, Third Stage. Be sure to follow In the Studio on Facebook and hear more rockstar interviews at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard in the studio with Tom Scholz, Boston's Third Stage.
Welcome back. In the studio, I'm Tom Scholz with Redbeard.
Thanks, Tom. The immediate result of Boston's successful defense and eventual legal victory was that Tom Scholz could resume working on a third Boston album for release by another record company of his choice. But the precedent has left as much of an indelible mark on the music business as free agency did in professional baseball. Tom Scholz's victory in court was a modern-day Boston Tea Party signaling a revolution in the musician and record company relationship.
It's probably made some of those chief executive officers take a second look at whether they were going to really try to persecute an artist, because that has definitely happened over and over again. Well, of course it happened to me, being dragged through a lawsuit for 6 years that was, obviously was worthless. It was decided in the first court. There was no appeal. They lost the injunction against the record. It was a straight loss, but it took 6 years and just, a fortune for me to fight it. And I don't know anybody else that could have sustained that effort and come out of it at the other end, still with a career and, with an album being released and so forth. So I think maybe it has made some of the big cheeses at the companies have some second thoughts about it, although it still goes on. I know that following that CBS defeat that there was a huge change, turnover in management at CBS. I would like to think that I had something to do with that.
Can't you say you believe in me? Can't you see what you mean to me? Every day I think of you, you're on my mind. Some things in the past are better left behind. Every night I dream of you, the image is as clear as day.
all of Tom Scholz's obstacles in making this album were not limited to the courtroom. Over the course of 6 years in his basement studio, there were numerous power outages, floods, and a strange phenomenon with his early 80s master tapes of unreleased songs that had been stored for years during the long lawsuit.
Something had happened to the tape. It was a new type of mastering tape. And there was a chemical change in the surface of the tape, so it actually became sticky. And when I attempted to play it, just to roll it off the reels and splice it into the master for the album, it started making some really strange noises and then literally just jammed to a stop on the machine with the machine running. I jumped on it and shut it off, and I literally had to peel the tape back from the tape heads and from the guides and so forth. And that was my only copy of that mix. I had that was one of those rare occasions where I was had done a rough mix, you know, following a session. And when I decided I liked that mix better than anything else that I could come up with subsequently, so I wanted to use it, and it was the only copy I had. There wasn't even another mix that was close to it. So I had to get involved with the manufacturer that made the tape and talk to them, and they sent me out some kind of wild goop that came in this bottle that had to be applied to the tape while it was running in between two machines placed across the room. So if you can imagine this, I have this one-of-a-kind master that was I really couldn't duplicate. I couldn't do it again. And I'm spinning it off of one reel, and about 10 feet away, it's going onto another reel on another machine, and I'm sitting there with this little kind of Q-tip-type applicator thing full of this some goopy substance that I'm spreading on the tape while it runs between the two reels. An amazing thing is it worked.
In my mind, I can see reminders of a past decay, so far behind, like the shadows linger at the close of day, and we could see we were timeless dreamers of another day, and we were free in a dawning age. We had so much to say. Ooh, the nights you came to me, a pudgy lady so eager to be free, and the wind in your lungs. Oh,
side we had love to carry on, and I still hear guitars in the air as we sat in the sand. Oh.
Yeah, you know, just when you think everything else has gone wrong. I mean, a studio is one of the most frustrating places in the world. There's so much stuff. There's so many, you know, parts and wires and semiconductors and just so much that can go wrong, and it always does. So if you work alone like I do, whenever something like that happens, it's because you got to stop and you stop thinking about music and you have to think about the, you know, modules and replacement parts and tools and of all the things that could go wrong and always do, having the tape, having the recording tape turn into adhesive tape is like the last thing I expected. And it wasn't, there was a little bit of damage where it jammed to a halt, but it wasn't real noticeable, so I got lucky.
This is Redbeard in the studio thanking my buddy Tom Scholz. For interviews and exclusive live performances by the biggest names in rock, visit inthestudio.net. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Barbarossa Limited Productions, copyright 2011, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunette. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Be a part of the In the Studio network at inthestudio.net.